This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
So the task of an opposition, in my opinion, is simply to establish a reputation for competence. And then, if the government is seen to have failed, the country can turn to that opposition with a degree of confidence. If that reputation for competence has not been established, then even if the government is seen to be not doing terribly well, it might be re-elected.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to this edition of Kent Politics Podcast. My name is Simon Finlay and I'm the local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council. You join us in the week the Conservative leadership race really got going. So to talk about that and much more besides, we have a special edition devoted to an in-depth conversation with one of Kent's biggest names in politics, Tory big beast and football fan, Michael Howard, now Lord Howard of Lym. That's up in just a moment. Michael Howard, Lord Howard of Lym, has been the feature of Kent political life for more than 40 years. He was elected in 1983 as MP for Folkestone and Hythe, and during his 27 years in Parliament, he served in the cabinets of Margaret Thatcher and John Major, latterly as Home Secretary. He went on to lead the Conservative Party into the 2005 general election and is credited with turning his ailing party's fortunes around. After standing down as an MP in 2010, he was elevated to the House of Lords, and these days he splits his time between his homes in Kent and London. Michael Howard, welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast.
Thank you very much, Simon. Good to be with you.
And thank you very much indeed for agreeing to come on. Let's get straight to it. The result on July the 4th was every bit as bad as all the polls suggested, and Labour won the election with a massive landslide and decimating the Conservative Party to 120-odd seats. Is there any future for the Conservative Party now?
Yeah, of course. The Conservative Party is the oldest and most successful political party in the world, and it's been able to recover from many defeats before. And although you said the result was every bit as bad as the polls predicted, that's not quite the case. The polls predicted a 20-point gap between Labour and the Conservatives. The actual gap was 10 points. That wasn't reflected in the number of seats because, as you know, we have a first-past-the-post system. But a lot of Labour seats were won with very small majorities. So I'm not making any predictions about the outcome of the next election. But I'm quite sure the Conservative Party can and will recover.
I mean, such was the scale of this defeat that, you know, your old constituency, Folkestone and Hythe, one I know particularly well, went to Labour despite the incumbent Damien Collins, who's been there for a while, having had a pretty handsome majority. It was typical of many Tory seats. I mean, what went wrong for the Conservatives at that election?
What went wrong in Folkestone and Hythe was very simply that a lot of people who had previously voted Conservative voted for Reform. The Labour Party was the main opposition party this time, but they didn't really get many more votes than they or the Liberal Democrats had got in previous elections when the Conservatives had won. The difference this time was that the Conservative vote fell quite significantly because a lot of Conservative voters voted Reform.
Yeah, but surely that Reform presence was something that everybody knew about from the minute that Farage sort of stepped onto the stage. I mean, everybody knew that popularity was going to grow. The threat was there. Do you think the Tory party did enough to counteract that, to try and fight it? Or do you think just by the time the election came round, the Tories had already lost?
I think it was probably the latter. I think probably the case. There was one of the ministers in the last government wrote a very interesting article recently, and I think it was the Sunday Times, about the effect of the polls, that when the polls have been telling people for a long time that a Labour victory is inevitable, it's a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, and it influences the way people vote. And I think there may be something in that.
Really?
Yeah.
Don't you think it's anything to do with the fact that, you know, the Boris Johnson years were absolutely chaotic? You know, people were...
Of course, I'm not blaming the Poles, you know, single-handedly for the Conservative defeat. No. There were two things. If you look at the Poles and what happened, it's very clear. Before Partygate, we were sort of more or less neck and neck with Labour, not a great deal in it. After Partygate, there was a big dip. And then after Liz Truss, there was another big dip. And those were the two things which I think really made a Labour victory inevitable. That now, all I was suggesting in my earlier answer was that it might have been aggravated a bit, accentuated a bit, exaggerated perhaps a bit by the Poles.
Do you think, I mean, you didn't really address this, but do you think the Conservatives didn't really address the threat of reform or just had nothing to beat it with?
Well, it was very difficult to address the threat from reform, because reform can say things which the Conservatives can never match, because reform knows it's never going to have to do the things it says. A lot of people were undoubtedly unhappy about immigration. Well, whether Rwanda would have worked or not, I think it might well have worked. The Conservatives at least had a plan to deal with it. Reform talked about immigration, but they didn't really have any proposal which would enable them to deal with it. So that's quite a difficult thing to counter in an election campaign.
Do you think that, can you give any explanation as to why Rishi Sunak decided to call the election in the summer as opposed to, you know, what was widely expected to be November time?
I don't know. I mean, I wasn't privy to his thinking, nor am I now, and I can't answer that question.
You were a leader of the opposition at a time when you were the third Conservative leader after the 1997 general election. Just for the benefit of the listeners who are maybe not familiar with that, what was the sort of circumstances of you becoming the leader of the Conservative Party back in 2003?
Well, I became leader after Ian Duncan-Smith lost a vote of no confidence. And we were in quite a bad way at that time. It's a long time ago now, 2003 when I took over. We were in quite a bad way. But sort of fortunately for me, in a way, I think we were in such a bad way and we'd been divided and bickering for so long that there was the people were tired of all that. So I was elected unopposed and I was able to bring back a degree of discipline. And I think we were pretty united party, really, for the 18 months between the time I took over and the 2005 election. And we made quite a bit of progress at that election. Obviously, we didn't win, but we made quite a bit of progress.
Yeah, you turned the tank around. I think that's how they it was kind of explained at the time. You were plus 33 seats, is that correct? 33, rough 30-odd
that's
seats?
Right. Yeah. The biggest improvement in the Conservative Party's position since, I think, 1983, 28 to 22 years earlier. So we did make some progress, but not enough.
The next leader, this will be the first leader after the defeat, once Sunak officially goes. Can that leader realistically win the next election?
Perhaps. The thing is this, oppositions don't win elections, governments lose them. If you look at every election since the war, where there's been a change of government, it's been because the government is perceived to have failed. And if the government is not perceived to have failed, then no matter how brilliant an opposition or its leader, the government will be re-elected. If the government has seemed to fail, it doesn't necessarily follow that they will lose the election. You have to have an opposition to which people can turn with a degree of confidence.
Yeah.
So, for example, in the standout example is 1992, when the Conservative government was quite badly divided after Margaret Thatcher had left in controversial circumstances. But it managed to win in 1992, mainly, I think, because the country didn't really have confidence in Neil Kinnock and his Labour Party. So the task of an opposition, in my opinion, is simply to establish a reputation for competence. And then, if the government is seen to have failed, the country can turn to that opposition with a degree of confidence. If that reputation for competence has not been established, then even if the government is seen to be not doing terribly well, it might be re-elected. On the other hand, if the government is seen to be doing well, I don't think there's anything an opposition, however brilliant, can do to change it.
Do you think that politics, I mean, it's changed enormously in my lifetime. It's changed, you know, enormously in your lifetime as well. And you go from a situation where a prime minister can call an election in the middle of December, win with an 80-seat landslide and then lose it by an absolutely massive landslide in the opposite direction. I mean, do you think the politics has become more fluid because of the way people consume news, social media and all the rest of it?
Well, I'm not quite sure what the reasons are. I think probably lots of reasons, but there's no doubt at all. It's much more volatile today than it was previously, than it's been certainly in my lifetime and probably ever, I think. It is very volatile. People's traditional loyalties are much weaker than they used to be. And so you do have these big changes. And that's why I suppose it's perfectly possible that the Conservatives could win the next election.
The leader of the Conservative Party, whoever that might be, is going to have a big task ahead, not least in the same way as you described, you know, a bit of a split party, you know, too many factions and all the rest of it. But the leader will have to rebuild the party in some way. Does the next leader, with the best advice, to stay in the centre or move to the right? What would your feeling be on that?
No, I think these terms are rather misleading. And I'm not sure that the next leader needs to say very much about policy, or should say very much about policy, for quite a while, because he's not going to be able to do anything about it. You can only talk when you're in opposition. You can't do anything. Mm. And who knows the challenges facing the country in 5 years' time, 4 to 5 years' time, whenever the next election is, might be quite different from the challenges we face today. So I think talking about centre, right and all that sort of thing is a bit irrelevant. It's competence that matters. Important thing is to establish a reputation for competence. And if you can do that, and if the government is seen to fail, you've got every chance.
Okay, you know, whoever the leader might be, what advice would you give should that leader come to you?
The way you've got to establish a reputation for competence, and the way you do that, you haven't got all that many levers to pull. You've got to show that you're competent in the way you hold the government to account. And that's the constitutional duty of Her Majesty's opposition. So that is obviously really hugely important. And you can show your competence in the way in which you run your party, the way in which you unite your party, the way in which you organize your party. Those are the ways in which you can show that you are competent. And that's the challenge. That's what you've got to be able to do.
If he ever becomes the next leader of the Conservative Party, as was demonstrated after 1997, it's a bit of a hiding to nothing, really, isn't it?
Well, it certainly was after 1997. Whether it's a hiding for nothing now really depends on events. I think, although in the number of seats, I think the current Labour majority is even bigger than it was in 1997, it's a much more fragile majority. The 1997 majority was much more soundly based. And Tony Blair was a very different politician from Keir Starmer, much more charismatic. So I think it always was a pretty hopeless task to take over in 1997. It's not necessarily the same now, because the government's majority is much more fragile. I think Keir Starmer is... I don't think there's the same enthusiasm for him as Prime Minister as there was for Tony Blair. So I don't think it's quite the same.
You know this question is coming, so I'll not delay the inevitable. Who of the six that have put their names forward would you be tending to favour at this point, say if you were an MP and not...
I'm sure I'm not going to answer that question, because I'm not going to endorse anyone in this campaign. I don't think it's right for former leaders to endorse people in subsequent leadership campaigns. And the only exception I made to that rule was when Rishi Sunak was up against Liz Truss, because I knew Liz Truss would be an absolute disaster. So I broke my rule, and I did campaign quite actively for Rishi in that campaign, to no avail. But I'm now reverting to my rule, and I'm not going to endorse anyone.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Why did you know that Liz Truss would be a disaster? What was your thinking behind that?
Well, first of all, I didn't hold a very high opinion of her as a cabinet minister and the various jobs that she'd done. And the platform on which she was running for the leadership of for being prime minister of sort of immediately cutting taxes and increasing borrowing, which was that meant, I knew would lead to disaster. We were, look, all conservatives want taxes to be as low as they can be, consistent with other objectives. But there are other objectives, like keeping borrowing under control, keeping inflation under control, and so on. And I knew that the policies that she was advocating would be disastrous, as they proved to be.
Sir Keir Starmer, leader of the new Prime Minister, leader of the Labour Party, how do you think he's done in the first few weeks?
Well, he's I think he dealt with the riots quite effectively. He's made a lot of decisions which I obviously would disagree with. I think really seriously damaging decisions,
like such as
cutting investment in artificial intelligence and in the supercomputer, which was going to be built, which the previous government had committed itself to. And there are lots of decisions which I think are going to play out very badly, like giving the trade unions much more power, making it much more difficult for people to run their businesses. Everybody wants economic growth. Economic growth is the great mantra which everybody subscribes to, quite rightly, because it is the answer to many of the challenges we face. But economic growth is created by the private sector and in large measure by small businesses. And so you really, if you want economic growth, you should try and make it easier for businesses to succeed and not more difficult. And what Keir Starmer and his government are doing is to make it much more difficult for those businesses to succeed. So he's inherited a situation in which we are the fastest growing economy in the G7. That's not something for which he can take any credit for. I fear that because of the policies which he's introducing, that may not last.
Well, you were fairly staunchly right-wing when you were Home Secretary, and I think you famously said once Blair got in, he said, "I know what causes crime, criminals." But you must have been impressed with the way the rioters have been dealt with, you know, fast-tracked into court and sent straight to prison, no, you know, probation reports or anything. They just went straight to jail. It was clearly an area of government that Keir Starmer is quite familiar with, having former DPP.
No, I agree. I said in my previous answer that I thought he dealt with the riots pretty effectively.
But would you, does it not also beg the question that if they can do this for the riots, why can't this be happening all the time?
Yeah, because the challenges are very different. And the fact that you are able to deal with one challenge reasonably effectively doesn't at all mean that you're going to deal with the other challenges. So time will tell. I have my misgivings. Look, I hope the government will succeed because I want this country to be successful. I have my doubts. And whether those doubts will be proved to be well-founded or whether I'm wrong, time will tell.
Yeah. During your, so the latter years of your time as an MP, the whole business of asylum became a bigger issue. People were coming in the back of lorries into the terminal at Dullansborough and Folkestone. They were coming in and the back of lorries through the port of Dover, and to a much, much smaller extent, they were making their own way across the English Channel. That's obviously changed as security got more tight at Calais, at Fretun, and Coquelle. Those exit points, if you like, became much more difficult for the people to try and penetrate. So what's happened is that there's been this business model that has evolved in the past sort of 5 years where people are taking these very dangerous crossings across the channel. I remember you telling me sort of many, many years ago that when you were Home Secretary that you'd managed to sort of cut the number of asylum claims by 40%. And clearly something has changed along the way, that you had a problem in 1999 or 19, whenever it was you were Home Secretary, right to the point where today we still got this problem 30 years on. Nothing has actually changed. Why do you think we've still got a problem with illegal immigration across the channel?
Well, because we're a very attractive destination for people who come from countries that are much less well off than we are. And in recent years, we haven't found an effective way of deterring them. Now, when I was Home Secretary, I reached an agreement with France I persuaded my French opposite numbers that if they wanted, that it wasn't, they didn't want people to be congregating at Calais in order to come to the UK. And so it was in their interest to reach an agreement with us to take people back. Because once it became clear that coming to France and to Calais wasn't a way of getting into the UK, people would stop coming to France. So I persuaded them that it was in their interest to reach an agreement with us, which we did, whereby they took people back. And they did take people back. And for 2 years, from 95 to 97, that worked. I made one mistake in reaching that agreement. This gets a bit complicated. Mm. There had been agreed something called, within the European Union, something called the Dublin Convention, under which people would be required to apply for asylum in the first country within the European Union they reached, which obviously was hardly ever going to be the UK. So I thought that would work. So there was a clause in the agreement which said, once the Dublin Convention comes into effect, the agreement doesn't apply to asylum seekers, because I thought asylum seekers would be covered by the convention. The convention never worked. Most years we actually took more people in than we sent out. And so that was a mistake I made. It could have been rectified by my successors. There were other countries in the European Union who entered into bilateral agreements, notwithstanding the Dublin Convention. And my Labour successors could have persuaded France to stick to the original terms of the agreement I've reached. But they never tried, as far as I'm aware. They certainly didn't succeed. And that's the only surefire way of stopping people crossing the Channel. If they know that they're going to be sent back to France, then there's no point in their paying the people smugglers, and they won't make the effort. Now, whether the last government tried to reach such an agreement, I don't know. Whether the current government will try and reach such an agreement, I don't know. In my opinion, that is the only... Rwanda might have succeeded, we'll never know. But in my opinion, the only surefire way of stopping people coming across the Channel in small boats, putting their lives at risk and all the rest of it, is for France to agree to take them back. And if France agrees to take them back, they'll stop coming to France.
But do you think that the drivers have changed? I mean, 25, 30 years ago, people were fleeing persecution, but there was a certain amount of economic migration as well. I mean, people accept that. These days, the whole sort of imperatives have changed. The drivers are changing. It's climate change. It's famine that are driving people away from where they come from. It's not just to look for an easy life. There is a real problem, particularly in parts of Africa.
Yeah, but that's not persecution. We can't possibly take everybody in Africa who's suffering from drive to or famine. I'm all for helping those countries to deal with the problems they face. It was when I was leader of the Conservative Party that we signed up to the 0.7% target for international aid. I'm a supporter of international development and of helping these countries to improve their situation. But they're always going to be less well off than we are. And there are always going to be lots and lots of people, millions of people, who will want to come from those countries to this country if they can. So you've got to find a way of stopping them.
Okay. You're 83 years old. Do you see that as an achievement in itself?
I do. I'm astonished that I'm still around. I'm very grateful. Quite enjoying life, but I never thought I'd live to 83.
You're still quite active in public life. How do you fill your days? You spend a bit of time at the Lords, you spend a bit of time in Kent.
Yeah, I mean, I do spend quite a bit of time in the Lords. I have some business interests, which I enjoy, keep me occupied. I watch a lot of football. So I have no complaints, really. I'm a lucky boy.
There have been some chatter that there could be an upper age limit of, say, 80 in the House of Lords. Do you think that's a good idea, or do you think that's too limiting?
It's more than chatter. It was in Labour's manifesto.
Yeah,
but I think they're having second thoughts about it. A lot of their own Labour peers are very upset about it. Mm. I don't think it's a good idea. There are many people over 80, well over 80, who make a very substantial contribution to the workings of the House of Lords. I remember James Mackay, former Lord Chancellor, who was well into his 90s. I was always listened to with enormous respect in the House of Lords because he had vast experience, a hugely intelligent man, and what he said was always worth listening to and worth heeding. So I think that would not be a very good idea. There's a lot of noise about the House of Lords being too big and, you know, second biggest legislative chamber in the world after the People's Congress in China. That's true, but it's largely irrelevant because a large number of peers never turn up. And the House of Lords does the work of scrutinising legislation, which is very, very important. The House of Commons used to do it, but it hasn't done it ever since Tony Blair in 1997 introduced automatic timetabling of legislation. Before then, people used to spend in the House of Commons hours going through every bill line by line. And that's scrutiny, which is very important. It's the job of the legislature. Once automatic timetabling was introduced in the House of Commons, that really stopped. Now, there's no automatic timetabling in the House of Lords, and the House of Lords does scrutinise legislation very effectively. That is its main function, and it discharges that function very well.
You were born in South Wales. Your father was Romanian, and you came from a Jewish background. You passed your 11 plus at a grammar school, went to your grammar school, and then you got a place at Cambridge University and became a barrister before entering Parliament in 1983. What was your journey into politics? How did you get into the Conservative Party?
I was interested in politics from quite a young age, but I didn't really do anything about it until I got to Cambridge. There's some sort of myth that I joined the Young Conservatives at 15 or something. I didn't ever do that. But when I got to Cambridge, there were a whole host of us there, names you will recognise. Ken Clark, Norman Lamont, John Gummer, Norman Fowler, Leon Britton. We were all there. We were all active in university politics, in the Conservative Association and the Cambridge Union. And we're still friends, rather remarkably, although we don't always agree on things. But we're still friends. We still had a sort of annual reunion dinner, believe it or not. And that's when I really got involved in politics.
Since your time in Parliament, I mean, it's been 1, 2, 3, 4, it must be about 10 prime ministers, so there's from Thatcher through to Starmer. Who would you say has been the most impressive prime minister in that time?
Oh, Margaret Thatcher, by a country mile. You know, Margaret Thatcher was, in my opinion, the peacetime equivalent of my great hero, Winston Churchill. In 1979, when she took over, we were the sick man of Europe, and people thought that nothing could be done about it. I remember a great guru of the age saying, just before the 79 election, that it's all going to be disastrous because either the next government after the 79 election will not even try to do something about it, in which case the decline will continue, or they will try and do something about it, and then they'll become so unpopular that they'll be kicked out. Mm. And that was the conventional wisdom. And she changed all that. She did try and address the problems. She did many things which were unpopular, but the country, I think, responded to the fact that she had a clear vision and that she was a determined leader, and she was determined to do what she thought was best for the country. She's a very controversial figure still, of course, but I think she was a very great prime minister.
You're credited as being the person who sort of spotted the promise of David Cameron. Do you take that? Do you take that particular accolade?
I was very impressed with David from the first time I came across him when he used to work in the research department, Conservative research department. And if I was going to appear on Question Time or any questions, he would be one of the people who'd come along to brief me. So I was very impressed with him from the first time I met him. He then became Norman Lamont's special advisor. And then when Norman Lamont left the government and was succeeded as Chancellor by Ken Clark, Ken had his own special advisor. And he phoned me up and he said, there's this chap, David Cameron. Mm-hmm. And he was Norman's special advisor. And I've got my own special advisors. Do you know anyone who will take him as special advisor? And I said, I'll take him like a shot. And so he came to work for me for a year or so as one of my special advisors when I was Home Secretary.
There is a story out there, and I don't know whether it's true or not, you were at a lunch once with David Cameron's mum, and you pointed to David Cameron, who was sitting at the same table, and said, he's going to be Prime Minister one day. Is that true?
I think I probably said he could be Prime Minister, but in essence, it's true, yes.
I've never asked you about that, so I wasn't quite sure whether that story was just apocryphal or not. So there you go. One of your abiding passions outside of politics and family has been football, in particular Liverpool. You've lost Klopp. What's it going to be like this season, do you think?
Oh, I'm very optimistic. The key thing is that Michael Edwards has returned. Now, Michael Edwards, you've probably never heard of Michael Edwards, and most people haven't. But Michael Edwards, when he was at Liverpool before, was the data king. And he really used data to identify players in a way that had never really been done before in football. And, you know, it was because of him that we bought very inexpensively by today's standards, players like Mo Salah as the standout example, and there were many others. And then Michael Edwards left Liverpool and didn't do anything for 2 years. Many clubs wanted to hire him, but he said no. And now he's come back to Liverpool and he's in charge of football.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is the most significant thing that has happened. And so I have every confidence in him. If he thought Arne Slot was the best pick as our coach, he's coach, not manager, but if he thought he was the best pick as coach, then he's the best pick as coach.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got a great team. We've got lots of wonderful young players coming mm-hmm. through from the academy. So I'm very optimistic about the coming season. Now, you know, Arsenal have been rebuilding and they're a very good team. And of course, Manchester City are a very good team. I think that'll be the top three, but the order in which they'll be in the top three is anybody's guess.
During my days in Folkestone, I sometimes went to watch Folkestone and Invicta, and I'd often see you in the stands on your own in a barber jacket, hurling some sort of well-meaning advice to the referee. Do you still go along to see Folkestone and Invicta?
Yeah, I do from time to time, not all that often, and occasionally Hythe Town. You've got to support football at that level, and it's often very entertaining. But Liverpool's my real passion.
Lord Howard, Michael Howard, thank you very much indeed for your time today.
Always good to talk to you, Simon.
Thank you very much indeed, and you.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, that's your lot for this week. Many thanks again to our special guest this week, Michael Howard. Next week, I'll be back with my usual accomplices to cast an eye over the latest developments in Kent politics. Don't forget to keep an eye on Kent Online for the latest politics news from across the county. All the best.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.